Please turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 65. Isaiah 65 and reading from verse 17 to 25. This is our last in the series of the Gospel in Isaiah. As I've said most weeks, most sermons, Isaiah is the Romans of the Old Testament. It's the Gospel of the Old Testament. And this evening we come to the climax of Isaiah, as he brings us to this moment in the future of a new heavens and a new earth. So let us hear the word of our God. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity. For they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. In C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan the lion dies at the hands of the White Witch for the treachery committed by Edmund. And after he dies at the stone table, Susan and Lucy go to find him the next day. They find him dead, and they mourn for him. But after a little while, they become cold, because it's still early morning and the sun is only beginning to rise. And so they decide to walk around to get warm. And they walk away from the stone table and find a spot to view the castle of Caer Paravel. And as they're standing there viewing the castle, they hear a giant crack. And they turn around to find the stone table broken and Aslan gone. And as they walk back to the table, Aslan appears to them. He's alive and well. And they ask him to explain what's happened. And Aslan says, though the witch knew the deep magic of why I had to die for a traitor's sin, there is a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. The table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. That last phrase, death itself working backwards, it captures in a nutshell what this part of Isaiah chapter 65 is all about. Because Isaiah 65 is all about the curse in reverse, seen primarily in death itself working backwards. There's a mention of death or an assumption of death in nearly every verse from verse 19 onwards. If you just glance down in verse 19, we read of the sound of weeping and the cry of distress, which is most deeply caused by death. In verse 20, we read of an infant living only a few days, in other words, dying. We read of an old man not filling out his days, in other words, dying in the prime of his life. In verse 23, we read of children being born for calamity. And what worse calamity is there for a child than to face death? Calamity for the children of Israel was foreign invasion, where children were taken off into exile or some were killed. In verse 25, the picture of peace, where a wolf and a lamb graze together, presupposes a time when they didn't, when the wolf grazed on the lamb, when there was death. And then at the very end of verse 25, there is the mention of hurt and destruction, which also conveys death. So do you see it? Death, death, death. It's there in nearly every verse. And yet the passage is not about death and judgment, but life and hope. It's not about this present world that is full of death. It's about the world to come, which is full of life. The passage is about the new heavens and the new earth, in which there will be no more death. We see that in verse 17 and 18. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. Death is nowhere to be seen in God's new heavens and new earth, where his renewed people live. So why all this talk about death from verse 19 onwards? Because it's death being worked backwards. It's the curse in reverse, with death as its main symbol, worked all the way backwards to life. This is what is at the heart of the new creation. Life, family, fellowship, peace, with death nowhere to be seen. And this is where we arrive at tonight in our last sermon in this series in Isaiah, with a new heavens and a new earth, a new creation, with a life transformed in a transformed world. Remember how we summarized what Isaiah is all about? It's about the gospel story of how God saves his people through judgment for the transformation of the world. The gospel story of how God saves his people through judgment for the transformation of the world. The fulfillment of Isaiah's gospel was not seen in the nation of Israel being saved through the judgment of exile, though God certainly did do that through his surprising shepherd Messiah, Cyrus. But all that was just a shadow of what was to come. The fulfillment of Isaiah's gospel is seen in sinners, past, present, future, being saved through judgment by another surprising shepherd Messiah, God's suffering servant, who we heard about last Sunday evening in chapter 53. Through that suffering servant, God would save his people through judgment, a judgment that the servant himself endured. And as a result of that judgment, salvation event for God's people, God then transforms the world. And that's where we arrive at tonight, the transformation of the world. God's servant is not mentioned, but he's there in the background, because this new creation in verse 17 and this new people in verse 18 are all a result of the servant's work. And we'll come to that at the end. But the passage begins with God's renewed people in a new creation. Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy and her people to be a gladness. So far, the heavens and the earth in Isaiah have been witnesses to God's judgment on his people in chapter 1. They've been spectators who celebrate the salvation of God's people in chapter 49 and 55. But here, they are actually participants in the recreating work of God. They are not just witnesses or spectators, but the heavens and the earth themselves now participate in this creation of all things new. Heavens and earth denote everything. It's two parts to denote the whole. God is going to create everything anew. And it's going to be so new that the former things of the old heavens and the old earth will not be remembered. That is, all the marks and stains and dents of sin and its effects on the world will be completely removed from the world to come. They will be so removed that we won't even be able to bring it to mind. Death won't get a mention in this new creation. It'll be a bit like when you write something on the beach. When we were in Australia, Ben loved writing his name on the beach, and we would go down by the sea and write his name, and every day we went back, it was gone. The waves came and completely cleaned it off, and no one ever remembers his name on that beach. Well, it's going to be the same in the new heavens and the new earth. All the things that have been written onto our lives as a result of sin and the fallenness of this world will be wiped clean. We will not remember them. They will never come to our minds. And the reason why they will never come to our minds is because our minds will be full of something else. Verse 18. They will be full of gladness and joy. Gladness and joy will crowd out all the former things. There's no room for them. As Isaiah puts it so beautifully in chapter 35, "And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." They'll flee away because there won't be any room for them. We'll be too busy rejoicing, too busy being glad to even spare them a thought. That's the picture here. The double imperative, be glad and rejoice, covers every possible joyful feeling. The word forever counters the transience of our earthly joys that come and go. This is going to be sustained, permanent, unbreakable, unalloyed joy. But we're not the only ones who will be glad. You see that in verse 19? "I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people." God is going to be rejoicing. God is going to be glad. One commentator calls this one of the loveliest thoughts of the book. I think it's one of the loveliest thoughts of the Bible. God rejoicing over his people. God's heart being made glad by his people. It's quite a surprising thing if you think about it, because the Bible calls God the blessed God, which really means he's the happy God. God is the happiest being in the universe. And he doesn't need anything outside himself to make him happy. God has never been happier in the whole of his life. And yet here is the happy God finding happiness in us. I don't mean that he will stop being self-sufficient or that he will become dependent on us for his happiness. Of course not. If that were the case, he would cease to be God. I mean just what the text says. God will rejoice over us. He will be glad in us. It's an astonishing thought. Reminds me of that other loveliest of thoughts in Zephaniah 3, verse 17, where God says that he will rejoice over us with gladness. He will exult over us with loud singing. Have you ever thought of that? Heaven is going to be amazing when we hear the innumerable multitude of saints singing. About 2 years ago, I was in America at a conference in a basketball stadium, 7,000 people, Christians, one grand piano, and we sang. It was the most heavenly praise I have ever heard. It was phenomenal. But what about the angels singing? Isn't that going to be even better than that? But then on top of that, we have this line about God singing. What is that going to be like? He's going to sing over us. We will have put a song in his heart. The happy God rejoicing over us. That's the sound of heaven that awaits us. In this world, we can grieve God with our sin. In that world, we will do nothing but gladden God. He will rejoice over us. And so naturally, we need to ask, well, why? Why will God rejoice over us? And the answer's there in the second part of verse 19. No more shall be heard in it, in Jerusalem, in his people, the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. That's the general answer. And then verses 20 to 25 give us concrete examples of that general answer. The simple answer for why God will rejoice over us is because all sin and sorrow will be gone from us. No more shall be heard in us the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. The sounds of weeping and distress are the emotional expressions of sin's deadly work. C.S. Lewis said after he lost his wife Joy that it didn't take him much to reduce him to a whimpering child. I know what he means. Death can reduce us to a whimpering child. We groan, we murmur, we cry cries of distress. And in order to remove those cries of distress, we have to remove the cause of them. And that's what God is saying here. Not just will the emotion be removed, but the cause of those emotions will be removed. The other night, Ben started crying at the dinner table because he'd got a bit of sauce from Jaggy's curry in his eye. And there we were trying to sort of comfort him because he was crying, but it wasn't doing anything because he said, I've got sauce in my eye. You need to get the sauce out of my eye. So we had to go get the flannel and clean out his eye. It was only when we got to the source that we actually cleared away the crying. And it will be the same here. God will clear away sorrow and sighing because he will clear away sin and all its effects. And death is its greatest effect. That is the general reason why God will rejoice over us, because there will be no sin in us. There will be no death. There will be no effects of the curse on us. He will rejoice over us with singing. And then he gives us five concrete examples of sin and its many effects being removed. This is the curse in reverse. This is death being worked backwards. Number one, long and certain life, verse 20. Long and certain life. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. The focus here is death's deadly work. Death's work is indiscriminate. It's young, infants, and old are the recipients of its deadly blows. As Henry Wadsworth said, there is a reaper whose name is Death, and with his sickle keen he reaps the bearded grain at a breath and the flowers that grow between. Death is ruthless. It is no respecter of persons. It shows no mercy. It's indiscriminate. But more than that, it's always untimely. Verse 20. The infant dies at the beginning of their life. They live just a few days. The old man never actually gets to be old. He dies in the prime of his life. In either case, it's a picture of death's untimeliness. Death always cuts life short. Death's timing is never right. Did you hear about that Scottish boxer this week, Mike Toyle, who died in the boxing ring? 25 years old, he's left a partner and a little baby. That's what death does to us in this life. Robs us of our little ones before they get to live out their lives. Robs men and women of their long lives. But God says, not in my world to come. not in my world to come. Long and certain will be the life of my people. Then he gives an explanation. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. Now, verse 19 is one of the loveliest thoughts in the book. Verse 20 here is probably one of the trickiest thoughts in the book. And commentators give various views of it. These verses seem to contradict what we think of the new heavens and the new earth. They seem to be saying that there will be death in the new heavens and the new earth. They seem to be saying that there will be sin in the new heavens and the new earth. This is a good example of needing to interpret the obscure parts of the Bible with the more clear parts of the Bible. Isaiah 25, verse 6 to 9 is very clear. In the new creation, death will be swallowed up in victory. That's not unclear, that verse. It's very clear. This verse is a bit enigmatic. It's hard to know exactly what Isaiah means here. But I think we should interpret the clear, the obscure, in light of the clear. And I think the best interpretation of these verses is that these are two hypothetical scenarios from our world that underscore the longevity of life in the next world. So the young man dying at 100 years old is really saying a person would only be a young man were he to die at 100 years old. He would be in his youth if he died at 100 years old. That's how long we're going to live. And the last line, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed, could mean the sinner who lived only 100 years old would be cursed. In other words, they're supposed to live longer. Or were a sinner to escape detection for 100 years, the curse would find them and remove them from this new creation, so that sin would not actually ever be present. So I think it's two hypothetical scenarios here, taken from examples in our world about the longevity of life in the world to come. Whatever way we interpret them, I think we get the general gist. God is promising longevity and certainty of life. God's people will have a long and certain life. It's what Jesus called eternal life. That's the first thing. Second, secure and satisfying life. Secure and satisfying life. Verse 21 and 22. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. The picture here is one of insecurity and futility. The building of houses refers to home life. Building of vineyards to farm life, so we have life in the home, life outside the home. And in a fallen world, life inside the home and outside the home can be at times insecure and futile. For Israel, this would have referred to foreign nations coming in who could come in and invade their land and live in the homes that they had built, who could come in and take the grapes from the vineyard that they had planted. It's the picture of insecurity, of upheaval, of futility. And God says, no more. No more insecurity. No more futile living in the new heavens and the new earth. Because, verse 22, the days of a tree shall be like the days of a tree, shall be the days of my people. The tree, so far in Isaiah, is often used as a description of judgment. Remember the tree in chapter 1 that was dry, withered, waiting to be burnt in the fire? Do you remember the tree that was felled in chapter 6 for the judgment of Israel? The tree felled in chapter 10 for the judgment on Assyria? Well, here, the tree is used positively as a picture of permanence, of long years. One of the things I love to do when we go to the Botanic Gardens in Cambridge is look at the width of the trees, of the trunk. I love to think, how old are those trees when you see how wide the trunk is on some of them? And that's the point here. God's people will be like trees with thick trunks. They will have these long, permanent lives. We won't be like the grass of Isaiah chapter 40, here today, gone tomorrow. No, we will be permanent. We will live out long days. And not only that, we'll enjoy our work. The futility of life will be gone. So that's the third or the second thing that we will enjoy. A long and certain life, a secure and satisfied life. And third, we'll enjoy a fulfilled and family life. Verse 23. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord and their descendants with them. This futility theme continues from verse 22. But now it's not fixed on home life or work life, but family life. Here God gives the most stark example of futility. The woman who labors in vain, the parent who bears children only to hand them over to calamity. And death is the greatest of all calamities for any of our children. And this is what God promises to work backwards. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity. And God gives the explanation, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord and their descendants with them. Years ago, I visited my brother in Nottingham, and he was in a church there with a good minister, a godly man, and he said to me, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "Well, that's good, because grace doesn't run in families." I didn't really think about it at the time, but now that I'm a good Presbyterian, I have thought about it, and I think that he's wrong. Yes, of course, it doesn't mean that every child born into a Christian family is guaranteed to be a Christian, but grace and blessing does run in families. That's what verse 23 affirms. In the new covenant, God's promise is to our physical descendants. There are three generations here. There is the blessed of the Lord, there is their offspring, and there is the children of those offspring. Three generations. Blessing, life, flowing through three generations. This is fulfilled family life. Without sin, without death to interrupt it. In the old covenant, children could bear the punishment for their parents' sins to the third and fourth generation. And this is a picture of obedient life where children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren no longer bear the consequences of a first parent's sin. Again, it's the picture of sin and death worked backwards into obedience and life within the family. So we've seen long and certain life. We've seen secure and satisfied life. We've seen fulfilled and family life. And fourth, we see perfect and immediate fellowship. Verse 24. Perfect and immediate fellowship. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The picture here is one of complete and unhindered harmony between us and God. It's a stark change by how we live now in a fallen world. We're the ones who walk away from God, who hide like Adam and Eve in the garden. We don't go looking for God. We don't call out to God. But notice here what's happening. We are the ones who call. We're the ones who start the speaking, and God is there ready to answer before we've even spoken. There's the immediacy of response. There's the identity of the will. We call and he answers, which means we're in fellowship. We're on the same page. But just think about our fellowship now with God. Yes, we have fellowship with him, but think about how much sin and various things in life interrupt that fellowship. Just think about the things in your ordinary day that interrupts you and stops you and frustrates you from praying. Hundreds of things every day that hinder us from fellowship with God, but not in the world to come. There will be no frustrations, no interruptions, no excuses. There will be unhindered, immediate, perfect fellowship with God. And finally, there will be total and permanent peace, verse 25. Total and permanent peace. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. You remember these words from chapter 11 when we studied it a number of weeks ago, when we looked at Utopia or Edentopia, because this is a picture of paradise, Eden paradise. Paradise lost being reworked backwards to paradise gained. It's a picture of total and permanent peace. The wolf and the lamb grazing together is the cessation of old hostilities. Hostility has been worked backwards into harmony. The lion eating straw like an ox is the reversal of the old natures from carnivores back to herbivores. It's a picture of unfallen nature. And then there is the serpent eating the dust, which recalls God's curse on the serpent in Genesis 3, where he said that the serpent, Satan, would crawl on his belly and eat dust all the days of its life. In the end, the serpent dies. That's what happens to an animal that eats dust. You can't live on dust. It's a picture of the serpent himself being destroyed. And why does he put the serpent last after the wolf and the lion? Because behind all dangers, behind all hostilities, behind all fallen nature is the great serpent. He is the cause, the root cause of all that goes wrong in this world. That's why it's at the very end of this passage that the serpent shall eat the dust. It shall have no future. And that's why Isaiah concludes, they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. Hostility worked backwards into harmony. The rule of the serpent worked backwards into the rule of God. Hurt and destruction worked backwards into total and permanent peace. So these are the concrete examples of how God will remove sin and all its effects in our world. They're the concrete examples of why God will rejoice over us. Long and certain life, secure and satisfied life, fulfilled and family life, perfect and immediate fellowship, total and permanent peace. Death worked backwards. The curse in reverse. The new world, the new heavens, and the new earth. But where is the servant? Where is the Lord Jesus Christ in all of this? Is this just a secular hope of utopia? No, it's a Christian hope, because it's all founded on the work of the servant. Isaiah 65 only comes about because of Isaiah 53. And that speaks of Jesus, because in his death, Jesus was like Aslan in his death. He was working death backwards. When Jesus died on the cross, think about what happened in Jerusalem. The graves of some saints were opened and their bodies were raised from the dead as he was dying. When there was an earthquake at his death, Jesus began to make death work backwards. He began to reverse the curse. On the cross, Jesus was already remaking the world. He'd already begun the new creation. Death, that great symbol of the curse, was being worked backwards. And that is because Jesus himself absorbed the curse in our place. On the cross, Jesus was winning for us all of the things that we've heard about tonight. All of the things that we receive in this new heavens and the new earth, Jesus himself won on the cross. On the cross, Jesus undid death, but only because he died. On the cross, Jesus overcame futility but only because he experienced futility, dying without seeing any fruit for his labor. On the cross, Jesus blessed his offspring, beginning life for them, but only because he was cut off without any generation from the land of the living. On the cross, Jesus restored our fellowship with God, but only because his fellowship with God was cut off. He called to God, and he did not answer him. On the cross, Jesus won for us total and permanent peace, but only because he was experiencing the hostility of the world and fighting the serpent himself. So who do we have to thank this evening for this new creation? Not Isaiah, but the servant, the suffering servant, the one who in his death was crushing the serpent, working death backwards and reversing the curse.